What if I told you that there's a cure for chronic pain? Yes, for that pain you were told you would just have to manage. And what if I told you that that cure is already inside of you? Would you believe me? Welcome to the Let's Talk Mind Body Healing podcast, where we talk about how to truly alleviate chronic suffering.
I'm your host, Felicia Jaramus, and this is episode number 27. And I think you're in for a real treat with this one. So in this episode, I spoke with Lily Morgan, who is a somatic psychotherapist and a mind-body medicine expert. And she works with clients experiencing chronic pain to help them on their journey to recovery. So she's really in this TMS space. And like many people in this space, maybe even all people who end up in this space, she has her own chronic pain recovery journey as well. So in this episode, she talks about her recovery from more than 9 years of symptoms, as well as bringing all these amazing, wonderful insights that she has from working with clients and some of the lessons and things that she has learned. And she shares such an amazing amount of wisdom. And I was really pleased in particular to have a Hakomi therapist on the podcast, because I think Hakomi is not really very big in the TMS healing space. So it's nice to kind of get it out there a bit more, because it was really influential for me in my own healing journey. Otherwise, I don't really have that much to update on this month. I'm feeling a little tired, a little worn down. I'll leave it at that. We'll get on to the episode. As always, don't forget to follow the show on Facebook and Instagram at the Body Mind Healing Space. And don't forget to rate and review if you're enjoying, to help spread the healing message to others.
I am a provisional psychologist with my PhD or my doctorate in education, but I'm not a medical doctor. So all of the content that I provide about mind-body healing in any medium, including but not limited to this podcast and my social media channels, is for informational purposes only. No content provided by me is intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice. The purpose is to promote broad understanding and knowledge of various health topics. If you choose to use any information provided by me, you do so solely at your own risk. Always seek the guidance of your doctor or other qualified health professional with any questions you may have regarding your health or medical condition. Do not embark on a mind-body healing journey until you have the clearance from your healthcare practitioner to do so, until you have discussed how to apply mind-body healing to your own individual case. The methods discussed by guests on the show are not necessarily endorsed by me.
Welcome to the Let's Talk Mind Body Healing podcast. I'm your host, Felicia Jaramus, and today I have the absolute pleasure of speaking with Lily Morgan, who has agreed to come on and share her wisdom. So Lily is a somatic psychotherapist, Hakomi therapist, chronic pain expert, and advanced level pain reprocessing therapist. So that is quite a bio, Lily. I'm so excited to hear from you and get all of that wisdom, because like, you have quite a bit, I can already tell. So maybe to get us started, just introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about who you are, tell us about how you get into this wonderful world of pain reprocessing.
Well, thank you. Thanks for that intro. Where to begin? I'm sure you get that response a lot.
Yeah.
Well, I think, as is typical, my it begins with a personal story. I'm in my 30s now, and after I graduated from my undergrad degree in a completely different field, I studied abroad and had a really incredible experience, just like a eye-opening experience, and learned a lot about the world and saw a lot of the world. And I think that there's a way that it kind of cracked open this awareness and shell a little bit that I had. And I think all in all, it was actually a very challenging experience. And what I really primarily struggled with was sort of a reverse culture shock. So I came back to the States, and I think was grappling with, more or less an existential dilemma. And, I think one that can be kind of common, I think, in our 20s, where we're sort of faced with maturing, we're faced with starting to really observe ourselves and really be honest with ourselves and make our own choices for ourselves. And I kind of slid into a life that I didn't think much about. And I started to have, when I really look back on it, I realize I had mental health stuff coming up first, actually, but I didn't listen. I didn't even really maybe acknowledge that that's what was happening, because I was really wrapped up in my mask and my, I don't know, my strong, smart, capable, good girl vibes, just to simplify that message, And so I think I took it on kind of as a challenge, which is common for me. I took it on with like a lot of sort of grit and power, but maybe not of the healthiest kind. And so I started to have physical symptoms after college. And I mean the interesting thing, Felicia, is like I had these sort of year and a half long chapters of sort of symptomology that was of a specific kind. And then I would kind of land with just enough safety in some kind of physical intervention, or just enough of an adjustment that my nervous system would respond for a while, and then something else would come up. So I had like metatarsal foot pain, and then I had like left side of the body pain, swelling in my clavicle, pain in my hip. And then a little while after that, that kind of got better. I had digestive distress, kind of all of the possible things you could have
Wonderful
wrong with
game.
your digestion, I would have episodes of. And that was actually the thing that I think remained most consistent throughout. And then I had actually sort of an autoimmune arthritis in my lower extremities, primarily in my feet, my toes. And then I went really, really hard into elimination diets and sort of cleansing and a lot of lifestyle changes. So a lot of environmental kind of controls of those symptoms. And then, the last, like, I really like kind of feel like in a way that really helped with the inflammatory process that I was in, like kind of got my autonomic nervous system into, kind of shocked it into a different state. But ultimately, my very familiar learned nervous system patterns were still there in me. And a couple months later, all of a sudden I started to get like glute, low back, hip, pain. And that was probably, I mean, all of these conditions would have very severe moments and then would kind of level off. And I would like learn to tolerate, manage, and build patterns, and make your life smaller so that it all works. And it really was this last experience of this pain, which was behaved very much like a mind-body syndrome. And there was just enough information I was starting to glean online and in books. And, you know, I actually found Sarno and Nicole Sachs first, I think in December of 20, oh man, what was that? December of 2019. No, 2018, and was like cracked the book open, read half the book, you know, was aghast, like, oh my God, this is so me. And then promptly put it away and didn't come back to it for a whole year. You know, like I wasn't ready. I wasn't really ready to buy into it and to
amazing
have
how slow the entry into this space can be. How like it's almost like a peeling of layers back just to get in.
Yes. Yeah. Like it, and it feels like this little bit of, okay, let's take a bite. Okay, no, I'm going to put that down. I'm going to take another bite. I don't think so. I'm not ready.
I'm ready for
Too
that.
scary. And then, you know, I don't think it registers as, oh, this is too much or this is too scary, but we just use our structure that we have to make the meaning that we can make in the moment. And like, I just wasn't ready to look at myself in the way I needed to look at myself. So it was then it was a year later, I remember, because these both happened around the holidays. And I just was in so much pain at that point. You know, would have days where I wasn't walking and I was blacking out from the pain and nothing, I mean, nothing, like nothing, nothing, quote unquote, wrong with my body. And to be clear, some of these conditions I had did have things, quote unquote, wrong with my body, right? Like arthritis, redness, swelling. So there's a piece there of when things get further down the autonomic system. But this kind of triggered pain condition was just so stark and glaring and out of control and up and down that I like couldn't really ignore it anymore. And I think I was also kind of confronting my, you know, by this time it had been 9 years of these sorts of conditions and working my way through this. And I, you know, I basically realized that I had been going backwards the whole time. That as I was sort of imagining progressing, I was imagining healing. Really, I was sort of solidifying the mask and solidifying the protections and the control. And so it is scary to have to really face that in order to be well. And so, yeah, so then that's really when I sort of threw my hands up in the air and I was like, well, screw it. I'm going to just go all in. I don't have anything to lose. You know, which was a mindset that really ended up helping me stick to it. And it didn't really take that long for me in terms of the physical symptoms. You know, and this, if this can be hopeful to some people who might be listening, like you don't have to, I say this to my clients often, but like you don't have to heal, quote unquote, heal all of your trauma to get rid of your symptomology, because you just have to have an expanded container of safety enough around and be empowered enough to know what's going on, why you're having these symptoms and what you can do about it, and developing safety and doing some emotional processing, right? And some life self processing. And then, you know, we're still, like I think Nicole says, you know, this is about chronic pain, not human pain. And so, you know, it's not really about becoming the version of yourself that is finally good enough, right? Like making sure we're not fitting this healing process into the same core belief that hurt us in the first place. So I think there was a lot for me around like coming out of the symptom and getting that like last 10% better. That was all about like, I deserve to exist and be a human and be flawed and have my version of brokenness just like everybody else. And it doesn't have to be the belief that I am inherently broken, right? It's sort of like that message of like, I am not so special that I am the only person in the world who's actually bad at her core, you know, and like, like really, like really trying to practice that in these sort of micro ways. And as I'm, you know, I'm still kind of grappling with the ripple effects of my childhood experiences and also the experience of living with chronic pain for 10 years, you know, I'm still working through things, and I expect to always be working through things.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, to get to a place where there's genuine compassion for the processes that you have, the emotional states that you have, and then a capacity to tolerate the human experience. It's like those two things are really the things I feel like if we have those, you know, torches with us, it's gonna ultimately be okay, even if we're not okay.
Yeah, I agree. It's the compassion and the capacity to like handle and tolerate all of those things that are so key. You
Yeah.
mentioned there that idea of that last 10% better. I often hear that a lot from people, that there's that last little bit that hangs on in there, and it's really hard to get rid of that. Can you tell me a little bit more about that experience for you?
Yeah. Well, I think I might answer that maybe first, sort of from a like clinical
Of
standpoint
course, yeah.
perspective of like I really think that like one way to look at that is just that there is 10% of you that still doesn't actually believe that it's possible. Meaning, right, that belief is just another synonym for, am I actually safe? Am I actually going to be okay? So I think it's looking at how will I not be okay if I have no more chronic pain? So I was really recognizing, and I think this is, I see this with a lot of my clients, is like, we are on some level, we are, you know, and take this message with a grain of salt, but like we are attached to our pain. It gives us something. And usually that comes from such a deep place, usually a young place of needs being unmet or not mattering, and us having to create a structure of understanding ourselves in order to continuously throughout life try to work to prove that we might matter, that we are not bad. You know, and sometimes I see clients are working to prove that they are. But I think that the pain often becomes a way that a person can stay attached to believing these things about themselves because it is familiar. It's what they know. It's how they've created safety. It's like even if things are familiar and painful, unconsciously we choose familiar over the unknown, no matter how painful it is. Like that is the limbic brain. That is what we instinctually do. It's not like a fault. It's how we all operate, you know? So it takes that consciousness and that capacity to say, you know, having this pain is allowing me to keep this person close or to keep help at arm's reach or to be acceptable in what feels painful or to be allowed to feel my pain because our medical system is validated, right? When you hurt yourself physically, when you have a physical condition, you are given time off. No one questions you. Everyone understands you. It's like this kind of radical forgiveness that our society does not have a lot of. So I think that for a lot of people, it's how they access relief. It's how they access relief from the external world and how they access relief from the internal world.
Oh my gosh, I
So,
love that. What from the external and internal world? Yeah,
yeah.
can you
And
go on? Go on. I love
I,
it. Like the internal bit is so cool too.
yeah, exactly. And I mean, sometimes, I mean, yeah, I can speak a little bit more of how I got out of my pain experience specifically, but I will say I notice a lot of my clients, like a way that I will frame it is, give yourself the thing that your pain was giving you consciously, knowing you don't need it, but you deserve it. Like you are not a faulted human because you need a day in your room alone doing nothing. Call it a cheat day, call it a cave day, call it a dead day. It doesn't matter. It's about practicing letting yourself need something that's uncomfortable to you And I will do this little thought experiment with folks sometimes, saying, they're like, they'll say like, okay, I imagine doing that, but I'm still like, I'm fine. I'm just sitting on my couch, like quote unquote forgiving myself, but really I'm just anxious about the stuff I should be doing, or that sort of seed of guilt or uncertainty is still there. And I say, okay, pretend you had 103 fever. Like, if you had 103 fever, what would it feel like to let yourself sit on the couch? Like, if you had 103 degree fever, there would be no question that you would need rest. So just find these ways to kind of like essentially create new little neural pathways, right? Like, start creating these new thought experiments and visualizations and start creating new neural pathways. For me, that last 10%, I think, if I'm really honest, had a lot to do with like, I think in one way it had to do with sort of forgiving the pressure system that's kind of the perfectionist type A person, or the people pleaser, or whatever we sort of, the work that we kind of unconsciously do indirectly in our lives that exhausts us, whatever that might be. It's like a little bit of a relief from that pressure system. But I think honestly, deep, deep down, it was my deep need for contact and attention and being cared for that I felt I had missed. And that, that's an edgier place. But that's ultimately, like, if we can be honest about what the pain is really serving, how it might really be protecting us, then we become a person who can confirm those needs in ourselves without having to do it with symptoms or through the eyes of other people. My last, like, I would say I did a lot of the emotional processing work primarily, which felt incredibly profoundly helpful. I think that I could have used, I think it would have been really helpful for me to have like a PRT coach or someone in the process, like, even not even, back in 2020, that was, there really weren't many people. Like, it's really grown, I feel like, recently with the various organizations having, a training, like trainer directories and stuff.
Definitely agree.
I would have loved to have somebody kind of call me out on not being very nice to myself in this process at the beginning and just like taking it easy on myself, and creating, like, I was really going in to material and really feeling some raw stuff. And I wasn't, I think, like, what I try to have my clients understand now is there are two things that I feel like journal speak and expressive writing really does, which is how the nervous system actually really heals from doing that work is two things. One is our consciousness, and this is, I feel like, pretty general psychology info, but our consciousness is relieved. Like, we have psychic relief when things that have been burdening our unconscious come into conscious awareness, right? Like, that has a really common way of understanding that is people's symptoms can go away sometimes really rapidly when they like re-remember or actually finally realize the impact of a traumatic experience in their life. So it's sort of like these big shifts and these big reliefs in the nervous system can come from something moving from the unconscious world, pushing up into consciousness. And I often will notice that folks have a lot of like half conscious awareness. So it's sort of developing this like residue or kind of like Nicole Sachs's concept of the conflict kills. Like, we love being a mother and we hate being a mother. Or we really love something that's wonderful in our life, but we also feel addicted to it, right? Like, whatever the conflict might be, it kind of has this similar vein of sort of when we don't really fully realize how we feel about something, but it is a little bit half conscious, like it's bumping up against our conscious awareness, and that can cause like that friction in the nervous system. So that's like one thing. And the other thing is what I had mentioned before, which is capacity. So literally practicing feeling distress, emotional distress, while also knowing that you're safe, builds the capacity, or another term would be the window of tolerance, to actually effectively process information and process experiences from the past or feelings or blocks or whatever it might be. So I find that journal speak does this really incredible job at doing both of those things. Building capacity, you sit down, you take a deep breath, you're like, oh my God, I hate this, but I'm still going to do it. The distress comes up, we feel uncomfortable, but we're tolerating it. You know, we're stepping out of the safety consciously and we're not re-traumatizing ourselves. So we get capacity. And then you have the like bringing things into light, becoming aware of things in our life or in our past or in our personality that we need to address.
This is kind of like a sideways, but it's just kind of raised this in me. On your website, you talk about the concept of having overwhelming emotions. And I think this is reflecting on my own experience. When those things started coming into awareness for me, I was flooded by all of these kind of overwhelming feelings that I had never felt before.
Yeah.
What do you recommend for clients in that situation when that kind of starts to occur? Dealing with these feelings.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. And I think it's so common. You know, the first thing that I want to say is to remind people that these feelings or the emotions are not going to prove or disprove something about you. They're not necessarily indicative of reality, especially if we're processing things from the past, right? Emotions are information. And when we're grounded and we have an emotional experience, we use that as information. Like, wow, I'm sad about this. That's going to motivate me to take some time to rest, to process this, to see if something needs to shift. Wow, I'm angry about this. That's going to motivate me to take action, right? Like, emotions have a purpose.
Yeah.
When they're not supported, when they're not contained, when they're not nurtured, when they're not guided, when we're little, we don't learn that they're okay and that they're safe. And so the emotional experience inherently in and of itself becomes dysregulation, right? It triggers dysregulation in the system. And so I will say, like, first of all, it's okay. No matter what happens, it's okay. If you get really dysregulated and you feel terrible, like, zoom out really big picture, you're still okay. Didn't go as planned processing these feelings, that's okay. So the first thing is, like, let's not fit it into the narrative of, like, there's a right or a wrong way to do it inherently.
Yes.
And I really feel like the whole point is to get people to feel like they're allowed to exist, that they're allowed to be humans, that they're allowed to not feel good and not feel okay, but still be inherently safe and worthy. So, you know, I would say, you know, one of the things in terms of the window of tolerance that people, you know, from sort of like just an advice perspective would be like titration. You know, titration is a really great way. So toe in, toe out, feel it for a little bit, and then go and, I don't know, do some stretching, rub some lotion into your body, make some contact with yourself, do something that makes you feel like you're here, you're present. Getting support if it feels overwhelming, I think especially if you feel like the emotional intensity is causing confusion and like sort of doesn't feel like it brings any kind of clarity or resolve. Eventually, not necessarily every time, but like if you feel like that's not happening, that's sort of a good sign to get support. That there might be like some sort of water that you're swimming in that you need help seeing. And that's fair, that's valid. You know, I've needed lots of help with that.
Oh, so did I. It's
Yeah.
a whole new world when that all opens up, kind of cracks you open.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that if you're sitting down to do some emotional processing, like create the container, create the space, remind yourself why you're doing it. Like basically try to, even if you feel like you're faking a little bit, like try to get yourself to a place where you're like, this is a choice that I'm making. Therefore, I'm empowered. Because what you're telling when you sit down and you do that, even if you don't want to, you're telling your nervous system that these things that were scary are no longer scary. So it's a desensitization process. And it can take some time, but it actually doesn't have to take that much time. Another way to think about it is, and same thing, I think, with like the exposure, kind of exposing yourself to pieces of your life that you might have sort of avoided, things that maybe you thought triggered your condition, or objects that remind you of being in pain, stuff like that, is to think about the like stoplight analogy, where it's like, okay, if we live in the green zone inherently shrinks. When we only live inside of safety and we never take any risks, that world will shrink over time. And that happens really, really often for people with chronic pain to no fault of their own, right? The safety alarms and bells go off and we stay small, safe, closed off, predictable, isolate ourselves, et cetera. And so I think about like when you can. And when you can't, it's okay. But when you can, you step into the yellow zone and just try to feel the discomfort from a perspective of this is safe. I can hate it. That's fine. You can hate it. You cannot like it, but it's still safe. It's still a choice you're making for yourself.
I love that. It's a choice you're making for yourself.
Yeah. Does not mean that it's fun.
Oh no, it's not fun. I think this is
Isn't
like
that fun?
some of the hardest work people will ever do in their entire life. I think like
Yeah.
anyone who does this is so incredibly brave, and I've always said that like it's the hardest thing that you'll do, and like your brain, your nervous system wants to remain in those default states, and kind of getting out of those states is, hard.
Yeah, it's hard, and you're essentially teaching yourself to be how to be a whole other animal. Like, you know, and I feel like it's such a like that pain, the pain that people go through, the pain that I had for so long, like that was such a time when I really needed to move past some, I really needed to deal with some things, and I really needed to mature past some things. But my psyche was not on board. And so, you know, and it's, I remember not liking hearing people say this when I was in pain, but like there comes the day where you're grateful for it, you know, and you understand its purpose. Maybe that's maybe a better way to say it. Like, I understand why it was there. I get its purpose because this emotional shit is rough. And I remember thinking, like, you know, doing that emotional work. And when I kind of started and being like, I don't know, this isn't worse. Like, this isn't scarier. This isn't more threatening. This isn't worse. But now, 4 years later, 4.5 years later, what I did unpacking those emotions then has led to so much scary realization about myself down the line. That's now impacting my life that I'm having to make decisions around. That's really hard to face, really hard to heal. And so, you know, there is this sort of way that it was better. It was easier. It was familiar and safer.
I think for a lot of people, it kind of dumps their whole life upside down when they get in there far enough because they realize what they were doing wasn't working.
Yeah,
And that's really
totally.
scary.
It's really scary. Yeah, and it kicks up, like I feel like those core beliefs, and you had mentioned Hakomi. This is, I don't know, that's kind of the approach I take with a lot of the attachment and like longer term work with more complex PTSD sorts of folks in my caseload, that's really understanding and seeing the core belief is in us and how it has created, like it's an operating system, So at any level of awareness, it can come back in. So I often, like at some point with clients, have to say, I think that actually this belief that you're broken is why you came here in the first place. Not totally, right? Like it's usually blended with an adult desire to have, a better relationship or to kind of get more curious about what we want or have a healthier lifestyle, or there can be these motivations to come to therapy. But I think like often over time, noticing that like the way clients show up, the way they present themselves, the way they do and tackle therapy kind of inherently is blending sometimes with these core beliefs, and we have to kind of decouple them from the work itself so that they can kind of the same message, so that they can sort of feel out of control and feel like, they're not presenting themselves. They're just a mess. They're just in the chaos, or they're with the painful feelings, but also in relationship. But I think it's really easy for, and I think this is what happened to me when I used all these physical interventions to get well, dieting, all this kind of stuff was like, it fit right. It, like the seed of the motivation behind all of that was, this can't be happening. I have to stay good, right? Like I cannot be out of control. I cannot be chronically unwell. I cannot have this happen because I believe that that is the ultimate abandonment, rejection, betrayal, deep in my psyche. So all of those kind of controlling behaviors were just like, I'm just imagining I was just like putting coins in the piggy bank of, you're bad, you're bad, you're bad. And so it's not that you can't do those things, but it's, again, it's just understanding what you're doing and why you're doing it.
I can hear you. You've really unraveled the layers of your psyche, and I think someone who's done that makes a really brilliant therapist. So.
Thank you. Yeah, and I mean it's like, those, there's a lot of ways that incorporating all of that into my personal life has been a really big challenge. Like friendships that come and go, and changing our awareness of who we want to be around, who we want to be friends with, who we want to be in connection with, the health of our, primary attachment, and all of these things. And so,
The friendship, I was gonna say, the friendships that come and go are a really interesting one because I think this process can change you really rapidly, but people still have that kind of old version of you inside their heads, and it can be very like jarring.
And that work really takes, like, which I think with this, I mean, I don't even want to call it a subtype because I think that we actually all have our bodies talking to us at all times.
I
But
think too, yeah.
yeah, but it's like really letting ourselves recognize what that energy in us, that kind of like integral, decided energy is directly wanting. And that's so scary
Yeah.
because when we are integral with what we really want and need, we are literally risking how anybody else might respond to it, might leave or not leave,
Yeah.
might accept us or not accept us. And I think that there's, you know, as you like, we can really make that decision for ourselves. And our energy really, as you kind of like practice doing this, you kind of be like, okay, is this that pattern? Is this that way that I do that mental gymnastics where I try to make sure that nobody will ever leave me? And that just seems to prove that I ultimately am alone, no matter what, no matter who's in my life, right? Or am I going to put myself on the line and know that however this person responds, it actually can't prove whether this is true about me or not. I just take it at face value because they're a separate person. And that's hard. I mean, I feel like that is like the hardest human thing I've ever experienced.
That's really hard. I think deep down rejection speaks to. I think I heard Howard Schubert talk about it. There's like circuitry in our brain from when rejection used to mean like death. Like when we lived in tribal, to be kicked out of the tribe would be like death. But there are people.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think that that's true from just a child development standpoint, right? Because
Oh, yeah,
I think
rejection
like,
from caregivers.
yeah, and I feel like Gabor Mate's work on this is really helpful, and I'll often give him as a resource to clients. He's got great like short YouTube videos and stuff, but you know, he's got that video of authenticity versus attachment, which
Yeah.
really just like encompasses developmental trauma in such a beautiful way, because what he says is, as a child, we will always, every single time, sacrifice our own authentic or integral demands, needs, feelings, requirements in to preserve the attachment with our caregiver. And
Yeah.
the stipulation here, I feel like, is that it is a perceived threat. And that's so key for clients to know, right? Because they'll say, well, my mom didn't leave. Like, I was not abandoned. You know, my parent is a good person. You know, they're doing the best they can. And I'm like, yes, of course. Great. Let's take that. Let's take knowing that and just like put it on the shelf. Because what matters is what you perceived. You perceived a risk. You perceived a loss or a rejection or abandonment. Or a ton of micro rejections and abandonments, especially emotional ones. And so, what we ultimately end up doing is creating blocks and transmuting our own needs into all kinds of masking and all kinds of like patterns of our body, patterns of our psyche, patterns in our way of thinking. And a lot of that energy in us has to go somewhere. Right? Like, that's just the laws of physics. It has to go somewhere. So that's why we create these systems. And then we have to like unlearn the systems.
And it makes so much sense because for a child, to tap into that caregiver is survival. So you're
Right.
choosing, survival. And I believe it's Gabor Mate as well, who says that for a child, it's impossible for them to see their caregiver as flawed because their caregiver is their survival mechanism. So you
Yeah.
always turn it on yourself and you think, well, I must be the bad one. I must be
Yes.
the flawed one.
Exactly. So that's where those core beliefs come in.
Yeah.
If we feel hatred towards our caregiver, but it's not safe, there's no attachment that's secure enough where we are allowed to just feel that energy because this world is a hard one to develop into, right? If there's so much that starts to control us when we are children developing. There's so much in our society that doesn't actually make sense, but kids have to do it anyways.
Yeah.
So their emotional distress is very warranted, right? And so that wanted to go out, the energy that wanted to go out and be processed, supported, guided, made sense of, goes in. So it becomes a part of that internal structure, because you're exactly right. Like, we cannot make the parents bad because we have to live
Yeah.
and we know we won't live without them. I think that like for people who like a way to see that in present day life is when we're triggered and activated and our emotions feel like, whoa, the emotional response to this doesn't really like the punishment doesn't fit the crime kind of feeling. Like the emotions are really big for what just happened. That's a good sort of key to saying this is probably about something that's based in survival, because those big emotions come from feelings of survival.
Yeah, it's usually about something else, something from your past that your brain has been reminded of. I think I'm going through all of that at the moment, having, because I have a 1-year-old, and all the time I'm being like, just feeling all those feelings from when I was a kid. And it's like, this is not about this moment right now. This is about what happened to me as like when I was this age. It's really tough, actually, like really tough.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's amazing that you are doing that work right now. That's a lot. I'm not a mom, but I've heard a lot about that phenomenon of sort of like when the you're working on the age in you that your child is.
It's really true. I feel like because you could get all that stuff and you're like, oh, like yeah, this is because I was never allowed to have like a tantrum, or I was never allowed to. Like for me, this is a really dangerous behavior. Like
Right,
this would have led to
exactly.
isolation or being smacked or put in my room, or like so you feel like your body is like right in that threat survival state.
Yep, right. And that bond, I think a key piece of it too is that there's a bond there. There's an attachment there between parent and child, or a sibling or loved one, partner in particular. Like the attachment bond is also triggered, and that's why the feelings are so raw. It's like we might see someone else's baby crying and be regulated, be okay, but when it's ours, it's getting activated.
It's those little moments too. Like the other night, he was awake in the middle of the night, and I came in and I saw just like the look of like relief on his face when he saw me. And it was like, it just like melted me to like know that like I have like that I'm a source of relief and comfort rather than like fear or
That's
worry,
amazing.
Like,
That's everything.
it's everything. Yeah, it was
That's
like.
everything.
And then I had to deal with these really big, like, feelings of like, warmth in my chest. And it was like, yeah, even that was tough. Anyway.
Even the positive sensations and feelings can be overwhelming.
Yeah, definitely. We'll move on from that. The one thing I wanted to make sure we had time to talk about was more about Hakomi, because Hakomi was a therapy I actually used in my own healing. I went and saw a Hakomi therapist, and it was so amazing. But I think we don't hear very much about Hakomi in general in the mind body or TMS space. We hear a lot about things like somatic experiencing, which I are kind of similar, but could you tell me more about Hakomi and how that works and what you do with
Of
Hakomi?
course. Yeah, great question. I mean, I think a piece of that is the body keeps a score, right? Somatic experiencing was really highlighted in that book, and it's sort of a it's become a textbook of sorts in this field. So it's understandable. And Hakomi is a mindfulness-based somatic psychotherapy. So it uses the body. It uses the body as an access through time and an access to the unconscious. And so, you know, sometimes like I really feel like what I'm doing with my clients is time traveling, and slow is fast. So we slow down, notice sensation, and like in staying with the present moment experience, material just shows up. So my job is guiding that process and noticing, you know, kind of it's like a kind of a zoom in, zoom out. So noticing the patterns, the ways clients are showing up in a patterned way, in a macro way, in a systems level way, and eventually finding a way to bring light to that while also noticing the little things that the body is doing all the time, or getting clear about core beliefs and going right in on sensations and emotions and memories and images and words, and finding the material that needs to get processed like back in time when it was really kind of put into the system and changed the course of our development. So, you know, I the reason I find Hakomi, or the way I guess that I find Hakomi different, is it's a very beautiful method for developmental trauma. And kind of like chronic developmental trauma. definitely has a capacity to work with acute trauma and incidents and accidents and things like that. But that working sort of EMDR and somatic experiencing modalities that have sort of a linear methodology of processing through a traumatic experience. I feel like that's kind of where they really shine, and Hakomi really shines in like the muddy stuff, like the muddy pain where we just don't even know when or why or where or how, and starting to create a map for someone of understanding and also instilling new beliefs, missing experiences. So, like providing what didn't get to happen lifetime in the therapy session when they're kind of back in the memory. So we're creating these new imprints. And I, honestly, what I love about it is it's very principled. It's very like a way of being as a therapist. It's not quite as scripted or method oriented, but like if you, but I get to use my intuition and I get to use my own creativity and my own heart. And that's kind of why I love it so much, is because no session is like any other session. And like when you, I think the way that it can really get into these profound shifts for people is because, a Hakomi therapist that's really doing Hakomi is following the organicity of the person in front of them. Challenging them in a way that's just right, and working with the character and the material in a way that's just right, and providing missing experiences based on what they know about the person and what the person is showing in session over time. So it's a good question because it is kind of hard to describe, but is this resonating with you based on like
Oh,
you having worked with
100%.
someone?
So for me, I like Hakomi was incredible because you would just kind of go in. You didn't have a like, you wouldn't have like a, oh, I want to talk about this that's going on in my life type thing. I would sit there and then my therapist would be like, okay, let's have a look at in your body. Let's find a sensation in your body. We would follow the sensation. And then he would ask me questions like, okay, when does this sensation come from? Like, how old are you? Like, and
Yeah,
then it
how
would
is it
bring up
familiar?
memories and like it, so that really taught me that okay, what's happening in my body is like often a reflection of something that's happened in the past, and it helped me to really learn how to link those things and draw those maps, as you were saying. And then you would have those experiences where, it would be my little 7-year-old like crying by herself, like that's where that feeling come from. And then you would be able to go in and like tell that 7-year-old that like, you're okay now, and be with her and, reparent her. So it just like it opened up the whole world of everything like therapy for me.
Yeah,
Like it was incredible.
that's, I love that. I love that so much. And that's really spot on. It's reminding me of one of the reasons why somatic work is so different than talk therapy is, a way to simplify that is basically like when we are in our analytical mind, when we are cognitively wrapping our minds around concept and us and thinking about us and the world and incidences, and we're talking about it and processing it, we're using actually like a very precise and small region of the brain. And when we are connecting to sensation and the body and felt experience, that like lights up so many more regions of the brain. So not only do we have access to the web that these things are connected to that need to be worked on and become aware of, but we also have much more access to a neuroplastic state. So a lot of clients that, I mean, some of the clients I've worked with have done some plant medicine, and sometimes they'll even say, like, this almost feels like a tiny, like, plant medicine journey, and that's really the magic of working that slowly and becoming that sensory. It's just because you have so much more perception of felt sense experience online and activated. And so there's a lot more like rewiring opportunity in that way. And so people can kind of like, practice feeling those things, practice feeling into those things. And I think it creates such a capacity for people to understand themselves and see themselves and expand their ability to just be a person versus being like, you know, I have to quote unquote heal this trauma and get it out of my body. Like that has a very, it's not that that's wrong. And there are some ways in which that's true, but there's also some ways in that which that's a very Western, kind of pathologizing and also like humans as purity kind of perspective of we have to get this out of us because it's a bad thing that's in us. Whereas like, I really see the people who have long-term gains and change their lives are people who develop compassion for all the parts of themselves and know themselves well.
Yeah, totally agree. Hakomi was the best learning experience about, and the best compassion building experience. And that also sounds a bit, I don't know, but the best compassion building experience for others too, because when you can really see how those events have shaped who you are, shaped how you come to see yourself in the world, then you can have compassion for how others respond to things too, because you can understand that we all have similar things that have shaped us.
Yeah.
Like the.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that you don't have to like, you know, it's not about finding these kind of bad or wrong or incorrect ways of being and who we are. It's much, so much about like, okay, you know, like I will still say, you know, I don't have chronic pain. I still feel like I am the same personality type, if you will, right? Like I still have the same mask. I still like know how to show up and present and can charm people and make people feel really comfortable. And it's not that that's bad, right? That was like a brilliant strategy, just like so many other strategies that there are, like withdrawing, right? Or like whatever it is. But it's just noticing if the costs are outweighing the benefits. And if they are, you are the one who is responsible for tipping that scale back.
Yeah, and you develop that ability to notice.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I think Hakomi, just having someone hold that container for you as well, like that person is that container to help you.
Yeah, and that's what makes something traumatic, right, is the absence of a container to process and experience.
Yeah.
So a lot of times the what we actually needed in childhood was very basic and simple seeming. But like when you go back and you reprogram it and you provide that, it almost feels like tapping into eternity. And that's what nervous system regulation feels like. Clarity, calm, ease, relaxation in this kind of never-ending feeling.
Yeah, it does feel like eternity.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a beautiful place. We're probably getting close to an hour. So a beautiful place to start doing some closing questions, I think. Yeah, really enjoyed this chat. Thank you so much. It's been amazing. You've had so much wisdom to share.
Thank you for having me. It's been really special.
Yeah. Okay, so closing questions. Are there any particular resources or what are kind of your top three it's like healing things that you recommend to people?
Wow, that's a really good question. I would say journal speak. So finding Nicole Sachs and just using her as like a totem that's just going to hold that belief. She's really good at like helping clients believe that they're going to be okay. And it's so crucial. And I think so, like going along with Nicole Sachs's work, I think the other thing that was crucial for me was listening to all of her interviews and binging her podcasts, because I think for folks, the more stories you hear of people healing effectively, the more you're going to believe it's possible.
I binged her podcast and Annie Lindenstein's podcast.
Yes.
It was like on all day, every day, until I could find at least some that believe.
Yeah. And it's a very similar thing to journal speak, but just not necessarily, not ne like inherently emotional, but like sometimes I tell clients to just do a sitting practice where they're not doing anything. So you're not meditating, you're not focusing on your breath, you're not trying to think through things, you're not trying to calm yourself down. You're like, and it can be short at the beginning because sometimes it's very distressing for people. But like, you're literally, the whole idea is practice existing, doing nothing for 5 minutes. And if you feel things, just like let it happen. If you're like, oh my God, I hate this, let yourself say that and then just keep sitting there. Because it's this kind of distress tolerance around like just our pure existence, not trying to do anything.
I've not had that one mentioned before, and I really like that actually a lot.
Awesome. And then the other thing I would say for folks would be, I think, well, I guess two things come to mind. I think the last method would be like really helping, having someone help you figure out how to do exposure. So I think that that's really, really crucial. So things that you did not do, were afraid to do, triggered your pain, etc. Like finding a way to literally do exactly those things again. Because that challenges the belief more than anything else. Because what we resist persists. What we fear and avoid is exactly where the healing is. And I think it's a really important one for people to get support around if it feels overwhelming.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, and I did have something else, but now I forgot it. Oh, I was just gonna say, like, permission for people to be gentle on themselves, giving up physical interventions. But I do think that that can be a really important part. I threw out all my supplements, I gave up my entire diet. I just stopped doing that stuff.
Yeah, I did the same thing, and it was like all in one go as well, because it was.
Yeah, very intense, but I think really important. It's just like with an eating disorder, right? Getting back in touch with your body, like the last module of intuitive eating is about food being healthy. Because as long as you are believing that something's going to fix you because you're wrong and broken, you can't do the physical intervention. Just like as long as you feel like there's good and bad food, you have to keep practicing not controlling your food, right? And it's like that's the end of the work, is bringing things in that feel like healthy for the body, healthy for the lifestyle, because those things might be brand new things that you've never done before. They might be completely other ways of having a relationship with your body.
You're right in that. That's a really hard part of the journey as well. Is because that does require total change in how you relate to yourself. So yeah, until that point, it's I'm broken, I'm damaged, there's something wrong, there's something I need to fix, rather than seeing it as like everything I need is in here.
Yeah, and I think like permission for people to be pissed about that. You
Oh,
know,
yeah,
I
yes.
went through such a phase where I was like, this is my job. Are you kidding me? Like, I have been sick for 10 years and now it's on my shoulders. Like, I have been outsourcing and outsourcing and outsourcing and being told that that was the right thing to do. And now it's my job to figure this out. And I was so mad about that. And that's fair.
Yeah, there were two parts of the puzzle for me. One was like, you're kidding me. I've spent all this time and all this money and all this chasing and all of this. And really, like, everyone's lied to me about. And so I was really angry about what's out there first. And then I had to get really angry about, wait, this is my job too. Like,
Love that. Yep.
there were
So,
several.
you know, if people don't know where to start with their emotions, just start about how you feel about having exactly what you have on your plate right now. Let yourself feel that. It's a great place to start, is how you feel about the chronic pain itself.
All right. And lucky last, I always just leave this one open floor. Any last piece of parting advice or wisdom you want to leave listeners with?
Gosh.
It's a hard one.
Yeah. It is a hard one. Well, I guess here's the thing that I'll say is symptoms, it really is my understanding, my experience, my determination that symptoms are never irrelevant. We never just have symptoms for no reason. They're not just like from nothing to nothing for nothing, right? So if we have a symptom, if you've got something chronic going on, it's just shining a light on something, and healing is always possible. It's always possible because if the symptom is not irrelevant, which it's the most illogical thing to think that symptoms have no come from nowhere. Right. Again, that's not how physics works. It's not how energy and matter work. So that means that there is something to be done. There's something to be worked on. There's something to relieve.
Symptoms are never irrelevant. I like it. It's
Oh, well,
a
thanks for
thought
having me.
buster, but all right. Well, thank you so much for this conversation. I'm just going to hit pause on recording. It's been fantastic.
Thank you so much.